Om sahana vavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavirdyan karavavahai, ejasvinavadhitamastu mavidvishavahai. Om shanti, shanti, shanti. Om. Welcome to you all to our live webcast of our usual Saturday morning class. Although this morning's class is not usual at all because we begin a new text, Shankaracharya's Atma Bodha. Let me just check to make sure all these gadgets are working properly. Excuse me. Okay, looks like we're okay. So we begin our study of Atma Bodha of Sri Shankaracharya. Actually, we taught this here in our New Jersey ashram in 2001. Perhaps a few of you were with us back then. We sat in our old hall, very small, very crowded, and we studied Atma Bodha back then. We begin now today on our Saturday morning class, just to give you some context. Usually our Tuesday evening classes are devoted to very deep Vedantic topics and texts. We finished most recently our study of the Mandukya Upanishad with Gaudapada's Karika. It was a very deep study of Advaita Vedanta. Then we keep those classes for Tuesday nights and for our Saturday morning classes, which we are now webcasting every class. We reserve for classes which are, I won't say less deep, because nothing is, these are all Vedantic teachings, they're all very profound. But how can we say more accessible? We just concluded our study of Vedantic teachings from the Mahabharata. In our prior class, we spent 5 years going through selected passages of the Mahabharata that taught Vedanta. So 5 years of teaching Vedanta, studying Vedanta from the Mahabharata. Now we begin studying Vedanta as taught by Shankaracharya in his Atma Bodha. And this particular text, I'll introduce the text properly in a moment, but it's chosen very deliberately because it is accessible, it's wonderful, and it's pure Vedanta. I'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. First, perhaps we should introduce the author, Sri Shankaracharya. Most of you are familiar. He's generally located in the 8th century, although scholars love to argue. The accepted date by most scholars is 1,200 years ago, 8th century. Some renegade scholars, if we can call them so, place Shankara's age at maybe 1,000 years before. I think we'll let the scholars argue about that. I'm comfortable, though, with the date 800 CE, 1,200 years ago. I should mention that there are so many stories about Shankaracharya. He lived to the only 33 years. He established these four mathas, monastic teaching centers in the four corners of India, and so many other stories, including some very odd ones about Shankaracharya I guess the modern term is astral travel. He left his body and went traveling. Another story about him entering somebody else's body. These stories led someone to send me a question recently asking if Sri Shankaracharya was a tantrika master, a master of all these arcane tantra practices. And here we have to separate the man from the story. Stories, I should say. There are two traditional biographies of Shankaracharya, and all of these fanciful stories are found in those two traditional biographies. And of course, all the modern teachings are based on those two biographies. To understand what's going on, we have to understand that the ancient concept of biography was so different than our modern idea of biography. Today, if you buy a book or read a book on the biography of some person, you presume that that book is an objective presentation of the life of that person as accurately as all the facts can be presented. That's our modern concept of biography. It certainly was not the ancient concept of biography. In Shankara's time and even later, the role of a biographer was not to collect factual information and present it in the most objective way possible. The job of a biographer was to praise the person being discussed. And if there weren't enough stories about the person, the biographer was expected to make up stories, stories of praise, or not, if not making them up, but to take stories that had been passed along through the generations, stories that probably had no historicity to them whatsoever, fanciful stories. But the biographer had a responsibility to collect all these fanciful stories and present them in the biography. So when we study Shankara's life and read these biographies, it's virtually impossible to separate the fanciful stories from the true ones. Fortunately, it doesn't really make much difference whether Shankara lived only to 33 years of age or whether he lived longer, whether he established these four mathas or not, whether he could do astral travel and all of that. Does it make any difference? Our focus is not on the person, but on his teachings. And his teachings are extraordinary. He really is looked upon as the central figure in the teachings of Advaita Vedanta. Now, when I say the central figure, I don't mean to suggest that Shankaracharya invented Advaita Vedanta. He didn't. Advaita Vedanta, the teachings, come from the Upanishads, from the ancient rishis. The ancient rishis were the originators of these teachings. Shankara is renowned for taking those teachings of the ancient rishis and systematizing them, meaning he put them in a certain structure and in a certain order and made certain connections and clarifications. And in doing so, he endowed the teachings of the ancient rishis, which were pretty difficult to understand, but Shankaracharya made them so much more accessible. His writings are often called Gambhira and Prasanna. Gambhira meaning profound, Prasanna meaning very pleasing, easy to understand. Excuse me. Now, Shankara's works, in which he systematized the teachings of the ancient rishis, fall into three categories. One category of his works are his commentaries on the Upanishads I just mentioned. There are many Upanishads, over 100. Shankaracharya took the 10 Upanishads that were most focused on Advaita Vedanta. Many Upanishads are not focused on Advaita Vedanta, so Shankara took the 10 most closely associated with Advaita Vedanta and wrote brilliant commentaries on those 10 Upanishads. That's one of the three categories. The second category of his works is just one work, his commentary on the Brahma Sutra. Brahma Sutra is a very technical text that reconciles all of the Vedantic teachings found in the 10 Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita. So Shankara's commentary on that Brahma Sutra is considered one of the foundations of Advaita Vedanta. That's the second of the three. The third of the three kinds of works or categories of works attributed to Shankara are his independent works. The Sanskrit word for independent work is prakarana. Prakarana granta. Granta, a book, which is a prakarana, an independent text. And Atmabodha, that we're beginning our study of, is one of those many prakaranas. Perhaps the best known work of Shankara, prakarana work of Shankara, perhaps is Viveka Chudamani. Many of you may have studied that work. His other works include Upadesha Sahasri, very profound, wonderful work, huge. Also, Vakya Vritti. There are actually several dozen works attributed to Shankaracharya, in addition to Atmabodha. Notice I'm using that word attributed to. Just like we have a problem with biography, we also have a problem with authorship. We can never be, no, I shouldn't say never, it's extremely difficult to be absolutely sure who is the author of a particular text. The Ten Upanishads are most certainly Shankaracharya's works. They have a certain consistency among them. His commentary on Brahma Sutra is in exactly the same style. But when we come to these prakarana works, they're in a variety of styles. First of all, they're not commentaries, they're independent works. And they're in a variety of styles. So it's much more difficult to say with absolute certainty that one work or another is without doubt the work of Shankaracharya himself. Scholars would accept, for example, Upadesha Sahasri. Scholars would say definitely Shankara's work. And then about Viveka Chudamani, many scholars would say definitely not Shankara's work. And when we come to Atmabodha, scholars are divided. If anything, they're a little bit thinking that Atmabodha is not the work of Shankara himself, but could be the work of one of Shankara's disciples, either one of his four immediate disciples or some later generation of disciple. It's possible, perhaps even likely. But here again, what difference does it make if Atmabodha is the work of Shankaracharya himself or if it's a work of one of his disciples? The fact is that the work itself is brilliant and wonderful and contains pure Vedanta in exactly the way we find Vedanta taught in Shankara's commentaries. So there's no question regarding the content of Atmabodha. I have to say, Atmabodha, of all Vedantic works, without exception, well, I'm going to have to hedge my favorite text, of course, is Bhagavad Gita. You know, it goes without saying that that of all scriptures, Bhagavad Gita would be favorite. But if you were to ask me of Shankaracharya's works, which is my favorite, I would absolutely say Atmabodha. In fact, other than Bhagavad Gita, I would put Atmabodha in. To say second place doesn't sound good. I don't mean to demean it at all. Anyway, I love Atmabodha tremendously, and for a very specific reason. I made this comment in our prior class. If you didn't attend that class or see that class, let me just mention briefly. To me, Atmabodha is the equivalent of a Vedantic picture book. And let me explain why I say that. Vedanta uses many drishtantas. Drishtanta is a Sanskrit word for metaphor. And a metaphor is like an image in words that conveys some principle, some teaching. For example, a common metaphor that we use in Vedanta, and it's found in Atmabodha as well, a common metaphor is like the sun illumines all the activities of all the people on this planet, in the same way the light of consciousness reveals the activities of your mind. Like the sun illumines the world, the light of consciousness illumines your mind. That's an example of a drishtanta, a metaphor. Notice it creates an image, a picture, and these metaphors make these teachings so much more accessible, easier to grasp, vivid. And Atmabodha, I think, is unique amongst all other Vedantic texts in its extensive use of these drishtantas, these metaphors. And when I say extensive, almost every verse has a drishtanta, a metaphor. So it's like a picture accompanying every story. Do you remember when you were a child and you would read these picture books, there'd be a story with a picture attached to that story? And, you know, if there were no picture, you might have found yourself less attracted to that particular story. But the presence of the picture in your book made those stories so much more appealing to us as children. So to me, this Atmabodha is like those picture books. Not that there's a physical picture, but rather there is a drishtanta, a metaphor, associated with almost every verse. In fact, we'll see, I think the second verse, we get our first metaphor, and we'll see that in just a few moments. Okay, anything else by way of introduction I should mention? Get that slide here. So the text has 67 verses. Some editions have 68. And they fall into these different topics. We'll be looking at these topics as we go along. Right now it's not very meaningful. When I prepare for classes, I'll be also studying a traditional commentary on the text Atmabodha. The commentary is attributed to Padmapada, Shankara's direct disciple. There's no need to bring that directly into our class, but I'll be making some references to it perhaps as we go along. I should also mention that these slides that you're looking at is available in a printed form on our website. A printed form means you have to print it out, but you can go to our website, go to the Atmabodha page, and you'll find the slides that you'll be seeing in this class. So you can print out a copy of those slides if you like. Also, the audio recordings of these classes will also be available on that same website page. Some people like to listen to the audios as they're like driving a car or maybe taking a walk. They'll use some headphones. If that's of interest to you, you'll find the audios available. Of course, all the video recordings, our webcasts are all available on YouTube. Okay, enough introduction. That'll lead us to the first of the 67 verses. It's traditional for students to repeat each verse after the teacher, so you can listen and repeat after me, please. Tapo bhikshina papanam, tapo bhikshina papanam, shantanam vitaraginam, shantanam vitaraginam, mumukshunam apekshoyam, mumukshunam apekshoyam, atma bodho vidhiyate, atma bodho vidhiyate. The first verse. And in the last line of the first verse, Shankara says, atma bodha vidhiyate. I'll mention that when I recite the individual words, like atma bodha, you'll find that the form that I recite is different than the form that you chant, and that's due to grammar rules. Rules of grammar are such that when words are side by side in a verse, the spelling of those words changes due to rules called sandhi. But when I'm teaching the individual words, the teacher is supposed to break the words apart. So when I quote individual words, they'll frequently be slightly different than what you see in the verse because I'm breaking the words apart for you. It's called sandhi vicheda, the separation of the sandhis, of the combinations. So that last line, atma bodha vidhiyate. This text called atma bodha vidhiyate has been composed and is being presented. By the way, there's a little pun, but a play on words. The word the atma bodha that comes here has two different meanings. One, it is the title of our text, so Atma Bodha Vidhiyate, this text called Atma Bodha is being composed, is being presented. But the second meaning of Atma Bodha is literally the Bodha, the knowledge about Atma, the true self, which is the subject matter of the text. And here in this verse, you can take it in both ways. Either this text called Atma Bodha is being presented, or this subject matter, which is knowledge of the self, is being presented. And we're going to come to the importance of that knowledge in just a moment. It's really the focal point of our first class. Before that, though, being presented for whom? To whom? Every text, every scripture, has an intended audience in mind. And just like books. You know, a book, remember when you were in school, you know, you had a book on mathematics and you had a book on algebra, a book on geometry. Notice each of those books had a different topic meant for a certain category of student. So, for example, you first had an algebra book and then later trigonometry. Perhaps you had a trigonometry book. And the trigonometry book came later. The algebra book came first. So there was kind of an order or sequence to those books. Books having different subject matters intended for different groups of students. This is such an important principle, and a principle that is woven throughout the Hindu tradition, throughout all of our scriptures, but it's often unrecognized. So let me point it out very clearly. The name of this principle is Adhikari Bheda. Bheda means difference, distinction. And Adhikari refers to the category of student, the kind of student, or even the preparedness of a given student. And the principle means that there are many, many different scriptures and texts in the Hindu tradition, and all of them are intended for different, all of the scriptures have different subject matters or different emphases and are intended for different students. Well, let's develop this a little bit. This is really the essence of this principle called Adhikari Bheda. For example, we just finished studying Mahabharata. Now, we excerpted Vedantic passages from the Mahabharata, but what we excerpted was just a tiny fraction of the whole text. We studied, some 2,000 verses out of the 84,000 verses that make up the total of the Mahabharata. We chose the Vedantic portions, but most of the Mahabharata is not Vedanta. Mostly it's story, but not any kind of story. It's an incredible story, and the purpose of that story is to teach Dharma. And notice that in the Mahabharata, we find teachings of Vedanta, including Bhagavad Gita, of course, occurs in the Mahabharata. But if you look at the main focus of those 84,000 verses, the main purpose of the Mahabharata is to teach Dharma, and especially how to interpret what is righteous in really complicated situations. The Mahabharata presents all these incredibly complex scenarios. And then it teaches us how to discern in the complexities of our own lives, how to discern what is dharma. We find the same subject, dharma, is also taught in the Ramayana. The situations in the Ramayana are not so complex as they are in the Mahabharata, but the focus of both the Mahabharata and the Ramayana is dharma. So if you want, as a spiritual student, if you want to understand dharma better, then Mahabharata and Ramayana are the preferred texts, since that's their primary subject matter. Suppose you wanted to cultivate more bhakti, more devotion, more of a devotional feeling in your prayers and worship. To cultivate bhakti, the Ramayana, and the Ramayana is okay, Mahabharata not so much so, but there's a whole other category of scriptures, the Puranas. The Puranas contain these wonderful stories of great saints and sages, very pious, and also all the stories, all of our stories about all the gods. All of those stories, including all the stories of Sri Krishna from childhood onwards, all of those wonderful stories are found in the Puranas. And the purpose of all those stories is to cultivate bhakti, to cultivate devotion. Now, the topic of dharma also comes in the Puranas. The topic of Vedanta also comes in the Puranas, but that's not the primary subject. The primary focus of the Puranas is bhakti, devotion, cultivating devotion. So if the primary subject matter of the Ramayana and Mahabharata is dharma, and the primary subject matter of the Puranas is cultivating bhakti. Notice this principle of adhikari bheda. Different scriptures having different emphases for different groups of students. Suppose we consider the Vedas, the root scriptures, source scriptures for the entire Hindu tradition. Many of you know that the Vedas are broken up in several ways. A very common distinction is to distinguish between the karma kanda of the Vedas and the jnana kanda of the Vedas. Karma kanda of the Vedas means the portion of the Vedas devoted to prayers and rituals, rituals in particular. The word karma there means ritual. So the karma kanda, the ritualistic portion of the Vedas, is for whom? Why is that emphasis present in that portion of the Vedas? Well, it's present. Suppose you are married and childless. There's a ritual in the karma kanda of the Veda, the ritual called putra kameshti. Putra kameshti is a particular ishti or ritual that is to be performed for the sake of the birth of a son or daughter. That ritual is taught in that portion of the Veda. So if you want to perform rituals for the sake of invoking God's grace to improve the quality of your life, you'll find those rituals in the karma kanda of the Veda. Or suppose you're thinking long term, not just this life, but next life, and you're thinking that you could accumulate enough good karma, punya, in this lifetime, that perhaps in your next life you could reach swarga, heaven. In order to accumulate enough punya karma, good karma, to reach heaven, you'll need to do a lot of rituals. Those rituals are specified in the karma kanda of the Veda. So here again, another scripture having a different focus for a different group of people. Finally, we come to the jnana kanda of the Veda, the portion of the Veda that's concerned with spiritual knowledge, the portion of the Veda that's called Upanishad, the portion of the Veda that comes last. Veda Anta, the Anta, the last portion of the Veda, are those Upanishads. That's why we call this Vedanta. And the content of those Upanishads, of the Jnana Kanda, the knowledge portion of the Vedas, the subject matter is this spiritual wisdom. Again, a specific subject matter intended for a specific kind of student. Now, what kind of student would go after the karma, go after meaning study, the karma, the jnana kanda of the Veda? Who would study the Upanishads and why? And this brings us back to our verse. So that last line, Atma Bodha Vidhiyate. This text called Atma Bodha has been composed in the, go up one line, third line, the last word, I am, this text called Atma Bodha has been composed. Why? Apekshaha, keeping in view whom? Mumukshunam. Keeping in view these mumukshus for the sake of mumukshus. This text has been composed for the sake of mumukshus. Who is a mumukshu? It's a Sanskrit word, maybe unfamiliar to many of you. Mumukshu literally means one who seeks moksha. Moksha is a more familiar word. Moksha means liberation, freedom. And we should understand, this is a very important point. Moksha, liberation or freedom, excuse me, the highest goal of life. There are two kinds of moksha or liberation. Very commonly, we think of moksha as freedom from rebirth, liberation from the cycle of birth and rebirth, which is no doubt true. But the blessing of moksha is not only for after this life. The blessing of moksha is also for within this life. In this life itself, moksha blesses you with a different kind of freedom, freedom from suffering. Moksha literally means freedom. In one sense, freedom from this cycle of birth and death, but in another sense, a very important sense, a crucial sense, moksha means freedom from suffering. And freedom from suffering is a goal every human being wants. Not just human beings, all animals, all creatures want freedom from suffering. And Shankaracharya says here that he is composing this text called Atma Bodha for the sake of those who want freedom from suffering. And this leads to the most important topic for today's class. And that is, Atma Bodha literally means Bodha, knowledge of Atma, the true self. And the most important question we have to ask right now is, how can Atma Bodha, knowledge of the true self, free you from suffering? Shankara says he's composing this text for the sake of mumukshus, those who want freedom from suffering. The content of his text, Atma Bodha, is Atma Bodha, knowledge of the true self. So the question, and really important question, is how can self-knowledge put an end to your suffering? That's quite a deep question. Let's take a few minutes and understand this properly. And to understand it properly, we really have to go back to the Upanishads and back to one of the central and most important teachings of the ancient rishis. I'm sure that you've heard the Sanskrit statement, tat tvam asi, you are that. That statement comes from the Chandogya Upanishad, and it is one of the most profound teachings of the ancient rishis. what it means, and we could spend many, many classes unfolding the meaning of that short passage, but the point for our discussion right now is this. When the Rishi said, Tattvamasi, you are that. And by the term, you is you. That is what? That means that divinity, that means God, that means a state of perfection, that means enlightenment. When, and again, this is a topic we can't get into detail, but I want to focus not on the tvam part or on the tat part. Tvam is you. Tat is that divinity, that which is God, that which is enlightenment, that which is a state of perfection. But what about the verb, asi? Everyone kind of ignores the verb. Turns out it's the most important. And the reason it's most important is it's in the present tense. How significant that is. The rishis said, you are that. The rishis did not say, you will become that. The rishis never said you have to do lots of spiritual practice and then one day, as a result of all your spiritual practice, you will become that. They never taught that. They said you already are that. My guru, Pujya Swami Dayananda, put it in some very simple but beautiful terms. He said, you already possess that which you want to possess. You already are that which you want to become. It's a beautiful way of expressing what the rishis expressed in those three words, tat tvam asi. And the significance is this, in your true nature, atma is the word we use for true nature, your true nature, atma, is already divine, already full and complete, already free from suffering. Then what is the point of spiritual life? And here's the point. The point of spiritual life is this. Your true nature, atma, is already divine, already enlightened. But you don't know it. You don't know your true nature. You don't know the essence of who you are, and that ignorance, not knowing the essence of who you are, causes suffering. So much suffering. This idea of ignorance about your true nature is taught in countless stories. Some of you know this story of the 10th man, Dashama Purusha, but I just mentioned the Mahabharata. The famous story in the Mahabharata is Karna. Karna, who was abandoned by his mother, Queen Kunti, as a child, and he was raised by a charioteer and his wife, who were of a very low caste. And Karna grew up being raised by this charioteer and his wife, thinking that he was also of a low caste. Karna didn't know his true royal identity. It's a metaphor. Because Karna grew up without knowing his true royal identity, he had an insecurity problem. He always felt inferior. He struggled with this issue a lot. He suffered a lot. This is an example to describe how the ignorance of your true nature can cause suffering. Here in Vedanta, there's a different kind of ignorance we're dealing with here. Not ignorance of who was your mother or father. This is a more fundamental ignorance. This is a huge topic. We'll do it very briefly now, and then as we go through the text, we'll be going through this in much more depth. Here's the point. Who are you in the most fundamental sense? Let's start with this. You are the one watching me right now. You are the one listening to what I say. Of course, you know very well that whatever your eyes see, you're watching some screen, whatever image your eyes pick up is conveyed to your brain and mind. Similarly, whatever your ears hear is conveyed to your brain and mind. So, who are you? In a more fundamental sense, you are the one who is aware of whatever is happening in your mind right now. Let me say that again. This is really where Vedanta begins. We're talking about Atma, the true self. Who is that true self? Who is the essence of who you are? The essence of who you are is the one who is aware of what is happening in your mind right now. Your eyes are conveying to your mind this image of me. Your ears are conveying to your mind the words I'm speaking. But in your mind are so many other activities, so many other thoughts, concepts, ideas, so many other perceptions. When you look around the room, you see so many other things. All of that is conveyed to your mind. In your mind are all your perceptions. In your mind are all of your thoughts, ideas, and concepts, and your emotions as well. When you feel happy or sad or angry or frustrated or joyful, all those emotions are also in your mind. And the point here is, who are you in an essential way? You are the one by whom all of these mental activities are known. In English, we have a word for it, two words we'll use, awareness or consciousness. By the way, in Vedanta, as taught in English, we tend to use these words interchangeably without any difference whatsoever between them, awareness or consciousness. To describe your nature, we say you are a conscious being, a conscious individual who is aware of whatever is happening in your mind right now. You are an awareful person, conscious of whatever is happening in your mind right now. This is crucial to the teachings of Advaita Vedanta because it gives us a starting point, and the starting point is consciousness. Who are you? Consciousness. Who are you? An awareful being. You are that awareful being or consciousness who knows what's ever happening in your mind right now. This is a great, great opportunity for my favorite question. My favorite question, some of you know it, you've heard it from me before. My favorite question is, so what? Some of you would say, isme faida kya hai? What's the point of it all? What's the purpose of this? We said before that this is supposed to be a solution to the problem of suffering. So far, it sounds very philosophical and maybe even a little bit abstract. So how can any of this possibly address the problem of suffering? Here's how. Karna didn't know his parentage, his true nature, and as a result, he suffered. In a similar way, you may not know the true nature of that consciousness we just described, the consciousness which is your essential nature, the consciousness that makes known all the activities in your mind. The nature of that consciousness, the true the identity of that consciousness is not known. We so often use another image, the veiled in ignorance. Your true nature is covered with a veil of ignorance. What it means is that the exact nature of that consciousness is not known to you. And let me explain how. you get it, I know you get it, that you are consciousness. This is our starting point. Yes, there is a body out here. Yes, there is a mind, and we'll talk about all of that. It all comes in Shankara's text in a wonderful way. The relationship between your consciousness and your body, the relationship between your consciousness and your mind, all of that we're going to discuss in great detail as we go through the text. But for right now, just start with this basic point. Your essential nature is consciousness. The consciousness by which all the thoughts in your mind are known, the consciousness by which all the perception, sight, sounds, hear, tastes and smells, etc., by which they arise in your mind, so the consciousness by which all those perceptions are known, the consciousness by which all your emotions are known. That consciousness is your fundamental nature. How could your fundamental nature be anything but? The most essential aspect of who you are is this conscious observer of whatever happens in your mind. It's absolutely fundamental. It's rooted in your own experience. It is an undeniable fact of human experience. This is where we start. Where Vedanta begins, however, is that the nature of that consciousness isn't known to you. You may not know that consciousness, the consciousness which is present right now, the consciousness which has been present in every experience you've ever had throughout your entire life, you take that consciousness to be something very ordinary. Anything that's with us every moment of every day, naturally we're going to take as ordinary. But the ancient rishis said, no, your consciousness is extraordinary. Tatvamasi, tvam, that consciousness, which is your true nature, is tat, is limitless, unborn, uncreated, vast. Your consciousness has no edge, has no boundary, has no limit, means your consciousness isn't stuck inside your head somehow. Your consciousness pervades the universe. Your consciousness was not born on your birthday. When your mother gave birth to you, the consciousness that we're talking about already existed, and already existed for all time, eternal, unborn, uncreated. And perhaps most importantly, that consciousness is perfect, full, complete, utterly unaffected by all the problems of life. We use the word ananda. In fact, that consciousness, which is atma, we define with three important Sanskrit words, sat, chit, ananda. This is three words that reveal the true nature of your consciousness. Sat, real, meaning unborn, uncreated, eternal. Chit, consciousness. The consciousness by which everything that's happening in your mind right this very moment is known. And ananda, full, complete, vast, limitless, utterly unaffected by worldly troubles. These three words reveal the true nature of your consciousness. Your consciousness is known to you in a general way. Just like Karna knew who he was in a general way. He was a man, a very complicated man. He was a man. Karna knew himself in a general way, but he didn't know the specifics of his parentage, and that caused suffering. In the same way, you know yourself in a general way as consciousness, but you don't know the specific nature of that consciousness as Satchit Ananda,
Sorry, I just haven't looked at this machine for a while and I get nervous. Seems to be working fine. So, you don't know your true nature as Satchit Ananda, and that lack of understanding causes suffering. How that suffering arises is another topic that Shankara will get into in much detail, so we'll set all of that aside. All of this that we've just discussed is to make one crucially important point. You suffer in life because you don't know your true nature. Puja Swami Dayananda, my guru, loved to use the word self-non-recognition. Due to self-non-recognition, you suffer. Not knowing your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, you suffer. Therefore, you are a mumukshu. You want moksha. You want freedom from suffering. We all want freedom from suffering. We are all desirous of moksha, free in the sense of freedom from suffering. And here's the point. How to become free from suffering. If the problem is self non-recognition, the solution is knowledge of the self. Self-knowledge, Atma-bodha. This is why Shankara says, for all mumukshus, for all those who want freedom from suffering, Shankara says, I have composed this text, Atma-bodha, to teach them what? Atma-bodha, self-knowledge. Why? Self-knowledge removes the veil of ignorance covering your true nature, will reveal your true nature as being Sat-Chit-Ananda, leading you to transcend all worldly suffering. How that takes place is one of the main topics that will come in our text. But all of this discussion right now is to establish this. Shankara, who is this text intended for? Mumukshus, those who want freedom from suffering. And what is the subject matter of this text? Atma-bodha, self-knowledge. And why is Atma-bodha being taught to people who want freedom from suffering? This is the ultimate solution. The ultimate solution to the problem of suffering is Atma-bodha. There are many temporary solutions. If you're suffering due to hunger, eat some food. But it's a temporary solution. If you're suffering from a headache, take some aspirin, take some medication. But again, it's a temporary solution. The teachings of Advaita Vedanta, which culminate in Atma Bodha, self-knowledge, this is not a temporary solution. It is the solution. Okay, let's finish this first verse. So, this knowledge is being taught for those who seek enlightenment. Now, whenever we speak of gaining knowledge, we have to deal with an issue. In order to gain a particular kind of knowledge, you have to be prepared to gain that knowledge. I gave the example of mathematics before. Before you can study algebra, you have to first study basic mathematics. So basic mathematics is a prerequisite for the study of algebra. The study of algebra is a prerequisite for the study of geometry. The study of geometry is a prerequisite for the study of trigonometry and other things. Remember when you were in college, every class you took had certain prerequisites for those classes. Here in Vedanta, Atma-bodha, self-knowledge, has several prerequisites. Not surprisingly, in order to gain knowledge, you need to be properly prepared. What kind of preparation is required? Go up to the first line. Take the fourth line first. We'll end with the first line. Second line. Shantanam vitaraginam. So this text is taught for mumukshunam, for mumukshus, for those who seek freedom from suffering, who are shantanam, who are shanta, who are peaceful, who are practitioners of meditation. That specifically is what it means. So the practice of meditation is one of the prerequisites for the study of Atma Bodha. And by the way, a lot of these details we're going to see in our next class with the second verse, so we'll hold off on that. Anyway, one of several prerequisites for the study of Atma Bodha is being shanta, calm, quiet, focused, one-pointed, all of which requires the practice of meditation. So just like the study of algebra is a prerequisite for the study of trigonometry, in the same way, meditation is a prerequisite for the study of Atma Bodha. Another prerequisite is in the next word, vitaraginam. This text is for those who are vita, free from raga, desire. Those who are free from worldly desires, those who are not distracted by worldly desires. This is pretty obvious. If you were distracted by worldly desires, well, you wouldn't be watching this video right now. So the point is that you already have this prerequisite, at least to some degree, freedom from being distracted by worldly desires allows you to be engaged in spiritual pursuits. Please note, most people are not interested in spiritual growth. They're interested in fulfilling their worldly desires. And as long as they're caught up in all those worldly desires, they will never be free to pursue spiritual growth. Therefore, freedom from worldly desires is another prerequisite for the study of Vedanta. And finally, another prerequisite here, tapo bihi kshina papanam. This text is taught for those who are kshina papanam, for those who are kshina, for those whose papas, for those whose sins have been kshina, removed, purified, tapo bihi, by the practice of austerities. Those who have been purified through the practice of austerities. Now, please don't think, oh, I haven't practiced any austerities, I'm not prepared. There's something very subtle and wonderful here. Shankaracharya, in a famous verse in Viveka Chudamani, he says, there are three things in life which are so difficult to get, so difficult that they're only achieved if you are incredibly blessed, if you are completely purified of all your sins and purified by good deeds you have done in thousands of prior lives. Shankara says you get three blessings. One is you're born as a human being. Second, you have a desire for spiritual growth. You are a mumukshu. And third is you have access to spiritual teachings. These three, durlabham trayam evatat, evaitat, devanugraha hetukam, there are three precious things in life which can only be achieved if you have been purified of all your sins through thousands of prior lifetimes. What are those three things? Manushyatvam, birth as a human being. Mumukshutvam, desire for spiritual growth, for liberation, freedom from suffering. And maha samshraya ashrayaha. Sorry. Maha purusha samshrayaha. Thank you. Maha purusha is guru. Samsharayaha, access to a teacher, access to a teaching tradition. Here the point is that you have, in American English, there's a word we use, we say you have won the trifecta. It's some kind of horse race where you win three different horses. Don't ask me. I've never been to a horse race. I don't know anything about it. Trifecta means you've won in three ways. You are born as a human being, you have a desire for spiritual growth, and you have access to a teaching tradition. You already have performed all those austerities, the very first word, tapas. You've already performed all those austerities in prior lives because you have already been sufficiently purified of all your sins to have birth as a human being, to have desire for spiritual growth, and to have access to a teacher and teaching tradition. You already have that qualification. What a tremendous blessing. It means there's no... Remember, if you didn't have a prerequisite, sometimes you had to do some remedial study. There's no remedial study required here. Meditation is required. Freedom from worldly desires is required. But the most important things have already been achieved. You have birth as a human being. You have a desire for spiritual growth. You have access to these wonderful spiritual teachings. All God's blessings. What could be more wonderful than that? We'll continue in our next class. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah, Sarve Santu Niramayah, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om tat sat.